From Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 Houston, this is Open Journal in Exile. Open Journal is the Houston community magazine of the airwaves. Join us as Duane Bradley and Stephanie Coleman explore the wonder that is the Petro Metro and the people who make it happen. And now from our temporary, socially distanced, alternative studios in exile, somewhere in the greater Houston area, this is Open Journal in Exile. Let the conversation begin.
Yes, yes, yes. Welcome aboard. You are tuned in to a special edition of Open Journal in Exile. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for your support. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. This week, we'll be visiting with Cherry Steinwinder and Joel Goza for another in our continuing series of conversations on race. As always, this is a conversation, and we'd love to hear your opinions, thoughts, and suggestions. Reach us via Twitter with the hashtag KPFTOJ or Facebook Open Journal. Subscribe to our podcast also. That's KPFTOJ.
Pretty easy, Stephanie. Sounds like
it. Keep it simple.
Hey, and I got good word from our teammate Maverick. A whole fresh batch of podcasts have been cast into
Yes.
Podcasts. So a fresh batch of shows have been put up there into podcast land. Wherever you find good pods cast, you'll find KPFT OJ, we hope.
This month marks 1 year since the horrific police murder of Houston's George Floyd in Minneapolis, a galvanizing moment for Black Lives Matter movement and the cause of racial justice in the United States and across the world. Open Journal has presented a series of discussions on race and racism over the course of time, especially this year. Cherry Steinwinder is founder and co-director of the Houston-based Center for the Healing of Racism, dedicated to the healing of racism through education and empowerment since 1989. Joel Goza is a Houston-based writer, minister, and advocate. His first book, America's Unholy Ghost, The Racist Roots of Our Faith and Politics, is an examination of the religious and secular thinkers who inspired our founding fathers and leaders' addiction to racist and classist ideas. Cherry and Joel, we're happy to welcome you again to Open Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having us. It is good to be back. It's been a long time.
We have not had you on in way too long. I'm sad to say that, but I'm so happy that you could join us both today.
Good to be back.
So, Cherry, I wanted to begin with maybe an answer, if you have one, to this question. Is America capable of dealing with systemic racism?
Duane, I've been out there now for 31 and a half years, and it's almost like waves. I see progress. I'm not going to deny that. But at the same time, I'm really journeying this show today, really sad. I feel like I should be in front of the Wailing Wall in the Holy Land and just crying. And the reason that I feel that, because the question that you asked is systemic racism. It is in everything. Every inch of this country. And the reason that I'm sad, and I feel I'm exhausted, because when I felt so hopeful for this country, and now what I am seeing, or what about to happen, is that they will pass a bill that will forbid me, Joel, or anybody else going into schools and talking about critical race theory, talking about white privilege, talking about systemic racism. And as I tried to process that, I felt like I was back in the days when people that looked like me were enslaved, when they were not allowed to even read the Bible, when they were not even allowed to read any types of books, so people could tell them anything that they wanted to tell them. But it was nothing to back it up. Joel, if your book was around, I wouldn't have been able to read it. So as I look at this sadness that I'm feeling, there is something in the answer to your question that I've been playing around with for a long time. All of these things that threatens the position of white people in the world, in this country. They will make up new laws. They'll change laws. They'll get rid of laws. And now, Joel's son, if he was in the classroom today and the bill passed, I would not be able to tell him the real truth. And it's like sitting down during the time of being enslaved in this country and not having access to knowledge. So, to answer your question, right now, even with the voting rights oppression, and then we're going to take all the, we're not going to let the kids have the information in the schools either. You know, that's really something to think about. So how can I rally around today at this moment that this country is ready? Because it really doesn't seem like it right now at this moment. Mm.
That saddens me to hear that come from you, Cherry, because you are an inordinately optimistic and mm-hmm. upbeat ally in this cause. And wow, that says a lot.
Mm-hmm. As we look back in history and we look forward to future generations, I do not deny the importance of what paperwork, legislative paperwork, policy means to behavior. You know, like my dad's generation was not allowed certain things, but they also didn't wait to be granted permission to do certain things. Is that still a possibility of human will to change things in spite of human paperwork?
Well, you know, I think when you see the paperwork, there is a relationship between the paperwork and the will. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is since 1776, we've had the answers to our country's mm-hmm. problems, particularly mm-hmm. on race. You know, we've had those answers. We haven't had the will to listen to those who had the answers mm-hmm. because they were black like Sherry, and they mm-hmm. understood the sickness. There has always been answers, and what the paperwork has reflected is that a white America was not ready to listen to what those answers can really look like. Mm-hmm. But what history also shows, and it shows with very stark clarity, is that black America doesn't wait around for permission to try to save the soul of our nation. And the last time that the rules of the game were really rewritten was during the Civil Rights Movement. And when you look at what happened in the Civil Rights Movement, in 1955, you have the murder of Emmett Till. And what do they try to do with Emmett? Well, the authorities in Mississippi try to bury that body just as quickly as possible. And when Sherry was talking about the inability to talk about our history, to talk about what is really going on, what when I see and read about the authorities trying to bury Emmett Till's body, what I understand is that that is our nation. That is what our mm-hmm. nation has continued to do, is that we have tried to bury the brutality of our life together and not allow it to see the light of day. And yet what happened with Emmett was that his mother outmaneuvered them, got mm-hmm. Emmett's body to Chicago, and she demanded that the casket be opened. And she refused to allow the mortician to beautify him and put all the makeup on him. And what she was trying to do was to get America to see what it is that we have done to our own children. And when you look at what Mamie Till does in that situation, it is what black activists have been doing all along. It's what Black Lives Matters activists are doing very effectively today. The work to keep the caskets open and to really deal with the history that we have there. And, you know, one of the things that James Baldwin would write is that a nation's politics is always a reflection of its spiritual life. Mm-hmm. It's always a reflection. And when you look at our nation's politics, what is very clear is that we have been a very, very sick nation from our inception. And the fight to save our nation's soul and to really begin to redeem our future, that work is always in the present tense. And it, of course, doesn't wait around for permission. But the struggle is very real. And as Sherry said, it touches each and every aspect of our life together.
Mm-hmm. Sherry, as you look back as a living experience of where the movement has gone well and where it has gone wrong, what are some of the takeaways that could continue to be poured in for good?
One of the things that I must say is that this sadness, this heaviness that I feel, and I am trying hard to remember all of the good things and all of the exciting things. But before I do that, I'm not going to fool Cherry, nor am I going to fool the listening audience, that I have to look at what is really happening in order to be able to apply that healing balm, that salve, on this sick society that's happening right now. So what has been really good? I think that it's been really good that I have been able to be in schools from kindergarten all the way to postgraduate school. That's been good. And at the same time, to be able to take this message all across the United States. You see, I've been personally in 45 states. I've sat down with heads of states and delegations of people that have come to the United States from all over the world wanting to understand American brand of racism. And so what is going to be the rally cry for me right now, because there is a rally cry. Joel, I'm so pleased that you are writing a new book, and I am very excited about the book you've already released, The Unholy Ghost. What I see now is that you better round up all of those books that talk about the history of this country. For people that look like Dwayne and Joel, you're going to have to be the ones to teach your children at home, just like we had to homeschool our children of what was happening within this country. Because if we can't go into the schools to be able to talk about this, it's almost like a cover up of, I'll say, the sins of this country, a cover up. So the only thing that I feel right now, as I said before, let me repeat that. People that look like Dwayne, people that look like Joel, you will have to be out there now educating your children about what's really happening. Yeah. Because if they're not going to get it in school, and what is hard, you're going to have to be good at it. Because most white parents are not good at talking about racism. So you see, you're going to have to take a course on how to talk about racism. Because if you're going to leave it up to schools now, it's not going to happen. So this is the rally cry. This is the cry that I want to take now across this country, that you're going to have to really stand in the gap.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the next book that I'm writing is on reparations, and it actually begins with a letter to my children. And one of the things that's so difficult to talk about is that throughout the entirety of our nation's history, white folks like myself decided that racism needed to be a burden that black people bore alone. And there is no future in that. There was this interesting statement from a former president of the NAACP writing in the era of lynching. And what he said was, is that lynching has situated itself in such a way in America that the question has become, how do we save black bodies and white souls? And that is really the work that is before all of us right now. You know, as I do my research and as I do my thinking, obviously I'm very concerned with my Fifth Ward community and the African American children here. But I'm also worried about the white children that are my children's age. What is going to happen to their soul? What is going to happen to their heart and their mind if we don't start telling them the truth about what our nation has been through, about the sins? And what will it be like if instead of taking a stand that white people don't share in the work that is right in our face at this time? And one of the things that I've really appreciated about what I've learned from your Frederick Douglasses and your Ida B. Wells and W.E.B. Du Bois is that hope never died. And it became frail, but there was always this recognition in the black protest tradition that the future is utterly contingent on the choices that we make today. And writing at the height of white supremacy, what W.E.B. Du Bois wrote is that white supremacy ultimately is fighting against the stars, that democracy will prevail. And he doesn't provide a timeline. But what we do know is that the invitation is always open for the fight towards an interracial and egalitarian democracy.
I have a question related to some recent experiences that I've had where we say the conversation between, let's say, Dwayne and Joel and white America versus a huge influx of immigrant populations that only have a very televised understanding of the challenges and the legacy of racism in America. So as you have a discussion about equity and justice, the conversation goes one of two ways. One, it goes right back to where it wasn't easy for me. I'm a immigrant. I came here and I worked and things are fine, right? It's like they've come after the struggle. It was work, but it wasn't institutional problems that they had to deal with. So they don't have a point of reference of like why you could just file a complaint and get resolution on that. That came off of a new struggle. Right. And because as Cherry was lamenting, not only is it not in the schools, it doesn't happen as a part of your intro into the country. And all you see are stereotype televised programs before you get to the country. How do we not only engage the black and white experience that is here to confront it, but the population that's indoctrinated on the wrong side of understanding? Where does that conversation begin?
This is Asian Pacific Islander Month. I've already conducted three workshops, one in Colorado and then two in Houston, calling attention to that history. And what is very interesting, I think, to look at that history of how people from all of those different countries came to the United States, and then they were muted. All the trauma that they went through, you know, they didn't talk about it. And it wasn't in the educational system for us to even understand or know anything about. If we wanted to understand anything about other people that's here in this country traumatized, then we have to do all of the digging ourselves to find out what happened to them, to be able to understand because of this month that there were people of Chinese descent that was lynched in this country. And it had, and not only elderly people, but even young people. So when I look at all of this, if we don't know all of that now, how much further traumatized we will be later when what is going on right now, we're not going to be able to talk about that either. The other thing, too, I really feel that a grave injustice was done to people of African descent with the arrival of people from Asian spaces, because they gave them something intentionally to keep them divided from us. You see, that's the hard reality. Even though I step up there and my voice is sincere and real, calling attention and wanting justice and a good life and everything else, but yet and still, with this whole thing about the model minority, it's like, you see, if you people, you black people, would just act and behave like they do, just look how quiet they are. They don't make waves. They don't call attention to their trauma. They are living that trauma in silence. And so we don't know people from Africa that I know in my family that's here from Nigeria, from South Africa. And yet and still, they look at us and even some of the elders say when they come to the United States to stay away from us. Because the only thing they know about us is what they see in the media. So that's another big thing of re-educating them that, you know, the interesting thing about it, you may be recently arrived from Africa, but at the end of the day, you are still a black person walking on the streets of this city. And if you don't have a sign on your chest saying Nigeria or South Africa, you are seen and treated just like another black person on the streets of this city. So we may have come at different times in different boats, but we're really all in the same boat now. And that is that education that have to happen so they can see my humanity and not just see what they have seen in their country of origin of me on TV, in the movies.
It is very hurtful.
You know, it's a really interesting question, because when you look at Fifth Ward and Denver Harbor are two communities that are side by side that are literally separated here in Houston by a railroad track. Mm-hmm. On one side of the railroad track, you have almost 100% Latino population. On the other side, it's predominantly African American. And for probably almost 10 years, I lived on the Latino side and I worked on the African American side. And what was so interesting was that it was clear that my neighbors in Denver Harbor, their understanding of Black America was provided by Fox News. Mm-hmm. That it was a complete white lens through which they saw their black neighbors. And so I'd literally hear things of, Joel, I'm not racist. I just don't like black people. You know, I mean, that was very normal. And on the flip side, sometimes African Americans' views of recent immigrants was also provided by the media. Mm-hmm. But the difference in the interpretation was, is that there was self-awareness about how race worked in America for African Americans that provided some type of difference of interpretations, you know, where they just didn't take Fox News at their word, right? But the whole immigration and the dividing from solidarity with African Americans has been critical to the American experiment. Following the Civil War, there's new census data that comes out. And what they start tracking is they start tracking new immigrants and what is happening with new immigrants and the newly freed. And what they ended up finding out is that for some reason, both of these populations are in poverty. And yet, due to anti-black racism, what is elicited is two fundamentally different responses. We knew that black America and their poverty and the crime in those communities is a reflection of inferior races. We don't need to have progressive public policies. But within immigrant communities throughout the nation, progressive policies came in to provide a melting pot that provided people a place in America. And yet one of the standards within the melting pot is that you couldn't stand in solidarity with African Americans. If a Jew stands in solidarity with African Americans, they will be treated as an African American. If an Irish stands in solidarity with African Americans, they'll be treated as an African American. And so there was a great divide that happened. And then in the 1940s, we start treating all white people, regardless of where they're from, as if they are white, rather than as they're Irish and Italian. And that's when whiteness is born. And all of our middle class in America today that says that they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps were benefited by legislation that passed in the 1940s that treated them as white and that explicitly cut out African Americans. And so the great irony is that the people that complain about African Americans getting assistance are the very people that have received some of the most assistance that our nation has ever had to offer, whether it's Medicaid or Medicare. All that came from the civil rights struggle. You know what I mean? We have been very dependent on the sacrifices of African Americans to make our country better. And yet we have always been ready to demonize the call from African Americans for our country to stand in solidarity with their well-being.
Thank you.
We will continue this important conversation with Cherry Steinwender and Joel Goza in just a moment. But first, Spring Fun Drive beckons, friends, and it's time for us to pass the collection plate. So reach into that wallet, reach into that purse, pull out that fantastic plastic. Call that phone number 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT, and visit with the folks on the pledge line. Share what you can. Every little bit adds up. It's dimes and dollars and quarters and Benjamins all rolled together that powers the tower that puts 100,000 watts of stereophonic people-powered FM radio out right here in the heart of the fourth nearly third largest city in the United States of America. You can also do it through the website, kpft.org. It is Monday, May 17th, 2021, and you are tuned in to Open Journal on Houston's community station, KPFT. Thank you so much. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. You know, always honored and humbled to be here with Cherry and Joel. Individually, it's a powerful conversation, but together, I just feel like super humbled to be able to have these free conversations, these honest conversations, these difficult conversations, mm-hmm. And to even guide our listeners into how you can have these conversations and must have these conversations at home, at school, at work, and wherever you see that these conversations need to be had. So again, Cherry and Joel, thank you for joining us. Thank you for doing the work that you do outside of this conversation and really for elevating all of us and our responsibilities to continue to fight and to be human about, you know, Cherry, as you said, the weight of what that feels like, and to have empathy for those who are continuing to be resilient, that is not without human emotion and without human burden. So again, thank you both.
Honored to be thank with you. You.
Mm-hmm. I just want you to know that the space that I'm in right now, this is the space I really need to be in. Mm-hmm. Because in this space, I will be creating, I will be reinventing the work to be able to roll the work out. Mm-hmm. In face of the challenges. So I really need to be in this space. And what I will say, what I've been knowing for 32 years, you see, I didn't wake up one day and say, well, today is a good day to start a movement. It didn't happen that way. I truly believe that I was thrust, propelled out there in front of this to do exactly what I'm doing today. And if I truly believe that, and I do, oh, no, I'm going to take a rest. I'm going to take a break. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to reinvent the work, and I'm going to reinvent myself, because it's too much depending on continuously having these conversations.
Mm-hmm. You know, as we talk about these conversations, the changing landscape of our country and the tools required to be capable of having these conversations. Joel, you've really done the work of writing curriculum. Both of you have really been educators, tactile, face-to-face, real educators in changing individuals and students of tomorrow. Are there curriculums and programs for our listeners to plug into that might be a great baseline for applying this to their lives, to their corporations, to their institutions that you both could share?
Jerry, why don't you take that one?
Well, during this time of being closed up in my house, away from my office, mm-hmm. I have to say, and I have to really look at the sacrifice of a life, the sacrifice of the life of George Floyd. Mm-hmm. It was because of his life that was brutally taken away from him that my whole life now is one workshop after another. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it makes it right now, because I'm able to do this by Zoom, social media. It's one workshop after another. And I know that if I had to travel to all of those sites physically, it would have been impossible. So we are doing these workshops for educational institutions, faith-based institutions, corporate America. We are being called upon by everybody, because as I said before when I was on the show with you, that death of George Floyd gave this country a word. And that word was racism. And so people are looking for conversations to talk about racism. And maybe that's the reason that this bill is coming up, because now everybody's talking about racism and, you know, critical race theory and white privilege. So, you know, we got to put a halt on that. So all of GWIS, everybody's looking for these workshops, and I am extremely busy.
And there really is, in many ways, there's an embarrassment of riches, I would say right now. If I had to name the 10 best writers working in America right now, they would almost all be African-American, almost exclusively. And there was an article that came out from Time magazine about the Black Renaissance, and you have people like Abram Kendi working. He recently finished a compilation with Keisha Blaine called 400 Souls that looks throughout American history. And it is a compilation, I believe, about 50 or 60 of the leading African-American writers working today. And Sherry's right, is part of the embarrassment of riches right now is technology. You can go to YouTube and Google James Baldwin, and you can spend an evening with James Baldwin listening. You can go to YouTube and Google Ella Baker and listen to Ella Baker, Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, Martin Luther King. That the wisdom that we need right now is available. And I think the question becomes is whether or not the vulnerability of white America will match the wisdom that is literally at the fingertips. And, you know, throughout this time that we have, you know, the question for me is always about vulnerability. Because without vulnerability in a cruel world, we will lose our humanity. And, yeah, there are excellent, excellent resources out there, people doing great work. The question is not whether the work is there. The question is always whether we are ready to receive it.
So, Joel, I want to follow up on the vulnerability. How can we, white people, expose our vulnerability? How can we learn to become vulnerable? What is a teaching methodology? What is a pathway that we could walk that would allow us to feel safe in doing that? When many of us are pretty darn comfortable right where we are, man.
Right, right. Well, and I think, so I have to confess, I come from a Christian background. I mean, that's the background that I come from. I've learned from a lot of other folks. But I think when you look at what does vulnerability look like, I think that you have to look at the Jewish tradition. And when you look at the Jewish tradition and what Jewish identity was and is and how it is fostered, is that it's always a confession of sin. And so when you look at the Hebrew scriptures, for instance, that is their founding fathers. And the first thing that they do is confess sin. And they have an identity rooted in being able to recognize the brokenness from which we come, confess it, and to be able to move on in order to not repeat those sins. So when we look at the forefathers of the Jewish tradition, Abraham, Isaac, David, Ruth, Naomi, we know of their sins and we know of their shortcomings because they were confessed. And they were confessed so that they wouldn't be repeated. And I think in America right now, we have to really enter into that confession mode and know that that's not an attack upon our identity. What it is it's a refusal to repeat our sins. And what the great challenge of living mature lives become is that we take the best of what has gone before us, and yet we name and refuse to repeat the worst of it. So that we can pass on a fundamentally different future to our children. And part of the way that we raise our children right now is I'm trying to raise my son to not be like me in so many ways, to not have the innate fears of black people that middle-aged white men like me have. And it is a great challenge, and it takes humility rather than the need to be right. And I think that once the thirst to live a more truthful life outweighs our desire to justify where we've come from or what we've done, we can find a very different way of living.
Mm-hmm. Parenthetically,
I want to just say something. I'm not going to call them confessing sins, but to be able to sit down in a circle, in a space with people that look totally different from you. And as people tell their stories, if they are willing to really open themselves up to be vulnerable, to be able to say, yes, I did this. People look like me did this. Mm-hmm. Maybe I didn't do it myself, but I definitely benefited from white skin. And at the same time, to be able to hear what it's been like for me in this country, to even look at, I was taught to hate myself in this country. And it took a lot of work for me to overcome that hatred, because nothing about me was good. The color of my skin, nothing was good. To be able to sit down and even speak that pain, this is something for all of us in one way or another. It's not so much what we did to ourselves, but what was done to us. Mm-hmm. And every one of them, really doesn't matter how white your skin is, it's been done to you too, mm-hmm. you know, because everybody that's on this planet right now, some way or another, it was done to them. Mm-hmm. And so when I look at that, I have to go back and look at in this space of reflection that I need to be in. I'm going to go back until 1978. This white woman that was working on the same job as I, for some way or another, I had a chance to, well, we became friends, and I went to her house. And here was her little bitty girl. And after being with me for a while, she looked at her little girl and she looked at me and she said, "My racist ideology will end with me. I'm not passing that on to my child." And this was in the 70s. So maybe it's something of making a commitment that, no, you're not, your children probably is not going to get it in the schools, but you can make a commitment. I can make a commitment that, no, I'm going to speak the truth. And I'm going to tell it the way that it is. Mm-hmm. You may not like it. And you may not even ever need to hear it necessarily, but I have a need to say it.
And you know, so, and I think that's a really important piece, even as, and for me, not only to the ability to say it, but Cherry, you hit a very point, to just be heard mm-hmm. is an amazing piece. Not to say, I have this feeling, and someone come back and say, "You think you have a feeling? Let me tell you about my feeling." It's like, wait, let me get mine out first. Acknowledge, validate that this feeling that I have might be real or is real. Mm-hmm. And from that point, the conversation can happen and not jump to, "I can't hear your feeling. Let's talk about mine." I think there is some etiquette and the listening, which can be quite a powerful piece in the conversation, more than trying to fix it, just to allow a voice to hear it could do wonders.
Yeah. Well, and here we all are on radio, we're in the media, we're having a conversation. Mm-hmm. And yet, as we're having this conversation, I'm thinking, okay, we can have this. Mm-hmm. We can begin to confess our original sins and to become vulnerable. And yet so much of our country is swimming in this mass media environment, not only Fox, but everywhere, especially there. There's an entire nearly 50% of our country that's having an internal debate over whether or not an insurrection happened and whether we will bow down to this former president who somehow has put the screws to an entire tens of millions of people, and our representatives, our so-called leaders, our civil servants are kowtowing to this aggregant and that kind of an example, ignoring what we all saw. This is very Orwellian to me, that we can watch this, and yet I have relatives who are telling me that it didn't really happen that way. We just heard, we just saw Liz Cheney. I'm no fan of the Cheneys, but what she said was speaking truth to her own little power block, and they chopped her head off in a closed room the other day. Mm-hmm. And replaced her with someone who was more of the sycophant style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because this isn't the first time that we have had people who tried to overthrow our government, right? And right. So the Civil War was people trying to overthrow our government. And yet when you look at what happens on the heels of the Civil War and Reconstruction, Klan violence runs rampant. Mm-hmm. And it's a war against interracial democracy. Runs rampant. And they elicit a congressional response, and the Congress puts together a 400-page report on Klan activities. But that didn't lead our nation to repentance. Instead, what happened was a very deliberate and very intentional misinformation campaign. You had Southern novels coming up that rewrote what slavery was all about. You had the entire research academies writing about the Civil War without the need to write about slavery, without the need to write about white supremacy. And the violent attack against interracial democracy and the organized campaign of misinformation is what gave rise to the age of lynching. That's what gave rise to it. And it dominated American politics for the next 60 to 70 years. And so the question becomes not whether or not a misinformation campaign will happen, because that's going to clearly happen. The question becomes is how do we keep that from being bipartisan, right? Because the truth of the matter is the war of democracy has been a mainstay in American history. We excluded black wisdom from American politics until 1960. We committed a basic genocide of African-American legislatures for the very brief time that there was an interracial democracy following the Civil War. And so what we are seeing is we are seeing a repeat of history, but that doesn't mean how we respond to this history has to repeat itself. We have to recognize what's going on, recognize the seriousness of what's at stake, and keep fighting for a future that can be fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm. That is something also, Joel, in looking at that, just this recent thing that happened this week. Mm-hmm. I think the larger thing is at stake. I know as a little child, I was always told not to lie. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure many little children were told not to lie. Mm-hmm. But now to be able to see that to lie, you can be rewarded for lying. Mm-hmm. And so you can also be punished for telling the truth. Mm-hmm. So you see, when I'm thinking about all these things, it is a really wide lens and a wide net that I'm casting to be able to look at how am I going to tell any child the truth and have them believe it when people in power, in position, they're lying and they're being rewarded for it. You see, this is a bigger thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it reminds me, like when you had talked about, you know, just a little bit ago, how we try to raise African-American women to hate themselves. You know, I've read the letter from Birmingham Prison for years, but this was one of the first times that I read it as a father of a daughter who was MLK's daughter's age, right? And so, like, it changes the lens through which you read it. And what you start seeing is that the saddest part was when he starts talking about being the father and watching, you know, that self-doubt creep in, the self-hate creep in. And throughout our nation's history, we have tried to convince black people that they were dying from self-inflicted wounds. All the while, it wasn't black folks holding the guns. I mean, these were never self-inflicted wounds. And, you know, the question becomes is we are in a very vulnerable time, but what does it mean that somebody like Joe Biden might have actually been learning something over the last couple of years? Even when it appeared at first that he hadn't learned anything from his mistakes, it seems like he has. What is the hope within that? You know, because I do believe that there is hope in the future generation. But I also can't imagine the type of changes that could happen if people my age and above started changing. Do I have confidence that that's going to happen? No, absolutely not. But do I think that there's a possibility to begin rewriting the rules of the game? I do think that there is. And it's a vulnerable hope that we have to fight for.
Sherry and Joel, there is never enough time. You both could be here every day we have a show and really, you know, just elevate our capacity to be human and humane.
Amen.
On these complicated, just in general, but these complicated topics. You know, we'd like to share with our listeners, Sherry, of course, the programs that you're doing at the Center for Healing of Racism and ways people can contact you, Joel, as well as your books and other ventures on your journey. So if you both could share with our listeners what's on the horizon, how they can stay connected, and how they can engage with your upcoming initiatives, that would be wonderful. We can start with you, Joel, and then we'll...
All right. Well, please connect with me at joeledwardgoza.com. There is a contact sheet. If you fill that out, I will get back with you. I have a class coming up in July that will be a four-week class. It'll be on Tuesday evenings for 2 hours. We'll be with people across the nation, and would love for you to connect that way. The book is America's Unholy Ghost, The Racist Roots of Our Faith and Politics. In the near future, not too distant, the book tentatively titled Rebirth of a Nation, Reparations and Making an Anti-Racist America. But I would definitely love to contact with anybody who's interested.
Mm-hmm. And Cherry, as you have done the longest work, we will end with your conversation of how people can engage and be a part of the amazing work that you're doing.
Well, our website is www.centerhealingracism.org. And on May the 25th, the date a year ago, when George Floyd was murdered at 10 o'clock in the morning, we are having an observance of that event, and the name of it is called I Can't Breathe. And we will also have one of the finalists from American Got Talent that will sing a song for us. And then on our fundraiser on June the 19th, we will be giving the award to, well, I'll put it this way, the center is going Hollywood. We are giving the Ally Award to Lupita Longhi. Wow. And I will have the opportunity, the wonderful opportunity to interview her. It will be by Zoom because we're not taking any chances with a large gathering. But all of those will be posted on our website as well as many other workshops that we're involved in. So it is with the greatest joy that I say thank you for letting me take a little while to just feel what's really going on and the weight of what's going on. But at the same time, after June the 15th, I'm not going to sleep as well, because as long as I knew Joel was in this city, I could go to bed and sleep well. Mm. But as he depart and Oklahoma become
Kentucky. I'm not crazy enough to go to Oklahoma.
I'm sorry, that's not that big thing, but the bottom line is I'm sorry. Know that to have you there, a lot of people will sleep. Also, well,
thank you, Cher.
It's been just a pleasure being with you, Joel.
The pleasure is certainly mutual. I look forward to eating all your food.
And thanks to this new technology, these conversations will continue, whether Joel's in Louisville or whether he's in the Fifth Ward, and whether you're down in Sunnyside or whether we're in the building on Lovett Boulevard or scattered throughout the Petro Metro as we have now for the past 14 months. Right. It's a joy and a privilege to spend time with both of you. We thank you for your gifts and for your willingness to share them. Mm-hmm. Sadly, friends, it is time to wrap this open journal. I'm Dwayne Bradley. Please check kpft.org for an archive of the program. There's also a donate button, and please use that. That will guarantee that Open Journal remains on these precious people's airwaves. You can subscribe to our podcast, please, KPFTOJ, and we're always open to your feedback. But that phone number is 713-526-5738-526-KPFT. Please do what you can. We greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I am Stephanie Coleman. Very glad to have this conversation. And we are a dedicated all-volunteer production staff, including Rambling Rick Campbell, Susan Phillips, and Maverick. And we couldn't do this without you, our supporters. Thank you for everything. Open Journal theme music is also provided by Kevin McLeod. Be here with us for Open Journal next time for more great conversations.
Hey, and as always, we like to leave you with a thought for the week. This is a quick one from Stevie Wonder, who said, "The right to bear arms, what about the right to live?" Take care of each other. Peace.